back to Happy Porch Radio, the podcast for ambitious agency leaders. This season is all about Umbraco, the friendly CMS. Join your host, Barry O'Kane, as he talks to web agency leaders and Umbraco experts about the challenges and opportunities that a specific technology like Umbraco brings to our agencies.
Welcome back to Season 2, Episode 10 of Happy Porch Radio. As you know, Season 2 is all about Umbraco, and one of the most common requests we had was for interesting case studies or stories about Umbraco in the wild. And I have a great example coming up for you. However, before we get to that, I'm pleased to announce that we will be hosting our second virtual networking event on June 27th. We're going to have some fun with this one. It's an Umbraco versus WordPress smackdown. I'll be joined by some amazing panelists, and I'm really looking forward to it. So save the date, June 27, and keep an eye on happyporchradio.com for details. On this episode, I am absolutely delighted to introduce Dan Sheridan. Dan is responsible for e-commerce in a global division of a large multinational, in fact, the third largest information services company in the world. And Dan shares the story of their multi-year project to pull a complex and disparate collection of technologies from across the globe into a common digital marketing and sales solution, a solution that depends upon Umbraco, and specifically Umbraco Cloud. This is a really fascinating project, and so, without further ado, let's meet Dan. Thanks, Dan. To start off, can you tell me a little bit about yourself and your background?
Sure. Thanks for having me this morning, Barry. My name is Dan Sheridan. I am a director of e-commerce at Wolters Kluwer in our global platforms organization. Wolters Kluwer is a multinational, third largest information services company in the world. Within Wolters Kluwer, we have a number of divisions, and I actually work in one of the very few global divisions focused on product development, market-facing, product delivery, and any market-facing activities in support of our business divisions. And within the Global Platforms organization, I'm responsible for e-commerce. So I work with most of our marketing organizations in our business divisions and help them take their websites, e-commerce sites, e-commerce applications, strategies to market.
Wonderful, yeah. And I'm really honored to have you on the show. When you talk about, you know, the scale of the company you're working in and the different products and the different e-commerce projects and products that you do, can you tell me a little bit, just to get a feel for the scale and the type of these projects?
Sure. So geographically speaking, I mainly address North America and Europe in terms of our working with my business colleagues and our business stakeholders in our marketing groups. The scale varies greatly from the North American sites, meaning Canada and the U.S. primarily, to our smaller country-specific sites and customer focus in, say, Hungary or Scandinavia. So that gives you a little bit of idea of the scale in terms of things related to revenue. You know, in North America and in the larger European countries, we're talking about millions of dollars in revenue flowing through these properties on an annual basis, to some of the smaller European countries where we're looking about hundreds of thousands in a year.
Really interesting. And I assume that covers a gambit of different technologies as well.
It absolutely does. We are currently in attempting a transformation in the technology stacks that are supporting this rather core capability for our businesses. You know, as you can imagine, in a multinational like Wolters Kluwer, the technology runs the gambit in this space. I mean, we have everything in this, what we call our digital sales and marketing space, from commercial SaaS solutions like Mozu to, you know, small, you know, WooCommerce types of sites supporting our businesses. And that's mainly due to the cost tolerance of each of our businesses. So what I presented at US Fest was really an aggregation of business requirements across the landscape in an attempt to come up with a common digital sales and marketing platform recommendation that met the needs of our largest businesses and business units to our smallest. And I think we really did a decent job at it. And as time rolls forward through the course of 2017 and into 2018, we hope that our recommendation will remain whole, let's say, as it hits our business landscape.
So what's the history of this project that you're talking about? It sounds like it's sort of a standardization. You know, the goal is a little bit of standardization. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, it is. Standardization to normalization of business capabilities. Preceding this project, the platform definition project, we had a year-long global strategy task force that recommended, one of the recommendations coming out of that task force was that we do away with all of the disparate tools that exist in the company to support a common single business capability. Analytics is a great example here, or even an e-commerce engine is another good example where we had proliferations in the dozens of the different things that would do analytics or provide the core business logic or commerce capabilities behind a commerce site, a commerce engine. You know, we had dozens of those, you know, all carrying different cost profiles. And the decisions to adopt those tools had been made decentrally. So, but when you roll it up at a more corporate or an enterprise level, the redundancy just doesn't make sense. It all require different skill sets, different knowledge base, and the support costs alone, let's say the tools were open source, the skill set and the support costs were being paid for multiple times over as a result of the need to for different skill sets and supporting the a common capability. So, you know, we're looking at this from many different angles, not just from a technology stack perspective, but also from cost and the ongoing costs as well to support the capability.
And so in that situation, are you when you're talking about support costs, do many of the businesses have, you know, is it internal team structure, you know, with an investment in a tech stack, or is a lot of the, you know, do you have the challenges of when you're, you know, with an internal team and transitioning to maybe a potentially different technology, or is it all external costs?
Most of it is external costs, hence the desire to consolidate knowledge and experience into a team that only requires a common skill set knowledge base to work from across businesses. So a lot of the businesses would outsource to individual agencies. So in many respects, what you're doing with your podcast, I'm the antithesis inside of a large corporation of trying to consolidate some things and streamline our businesses. Not to say that, you know, we do continue to use agencies even in that model. My team is very, very small, and 90% of my team comes through staff augmentation through agencies. So we're continuing that model, but we're trying to pare it down to something a little more reasonable that doesn't carry the multiples of redundancy.
Can you just talk me through kind of, you describe a year-long process. Can you kind of talk me through the start of that? You know, what the genesis of, you've got the situation and, you know, what drove the, okay, we need to fix this or we need a project to pull it together?
Yeah, what really drove it was our corporate strategy group regularly is running global task forces, taking a look at analyzing opportunities for overall business improvement. In 2015, we ran a task force on digital sales and marketing across our businesses globally, and a lot of things came to light. One of the more salient points, for me anyway, was taking a look at the redundancy of tool sets and technologies that was contained in the presentation I gave at US Fest. There's one particular slide that enumerates the number of tools, number of commerce sites for a very limited number of divisions. I mean, globally, we only have three or four divisions, and within those divisions, different business units. We haven't even achieved standardization or normalization of how we go to market digitally, even within a single division. And we're hoping to change that. We have a number of programs running now that will affect that. But these programs do take a long time. In 2015, the Global Task Force ran, one of the outcomes and recommendations was we standardize on a global platform. In 2016, we conducted some assessments of different current market-facing properties, did those assessments, came back and recommended that those assessments really did support the recommendation to adopt or go forward with a common set of technologies supporting the digital sales and marketing technical capabilities. And how we did that was we actually used guidelines, user experience guidelines from a company called the Baymart Institute. And they're based just outside of Copenhagen in Denmark. These guys have produced a phenomenal foundation of research to assess your market-facing e-commerce capabilities. They've published 461 guidelines for user experience in digital sales and marketing. So we used those along with our proprietary scoring methodology and aligned those with a digital maturity model published by the Gartner Group. So we combined two different sets of research from Gartner, from the Baymart Institute, and came up with a ranking and rating system internally, basically a balanced scorecard by which we assessed, you know, different e-commerce sites and marketing sites around the company. What we learned is that we score very low in most cases because of the focus on technology rather than the go-to-market message and the delivery and execution against a go-to-market strategy. So the marketing teams are consumed and spend an inordinate amount of time assessing technology, changing technologies on a regular basis, as opposed to driving conversions and improving market position. So, you know, that was very eye-opening for most of our executives in the company. And after that, we began to see a shift from the marketing teams and e-commerce teams really focusing on technology to focusing on the results rather than the technology. And that actually, while there was some internal tension about the results of our research and our assessments, you know, we're now close to a year in after publishing those, and we're really starting to see a shift in some of our divisions away from the technology, working with our groups or other groups in the company to say, hey, let's stop the proliferation of the tools and let's really start focusing on the business processes and the results that we want to achieve, which is very, very good. That will help our percentage of revenue that's done through e-commerce, that will improve our customer satisfaction or net promoter scores and things like that.
Yeah, that last point I think is something that is very close to my heart as running a small technology company, but not wanting the focus to be on the technology necessarily, but on the results that we bring or whatever. And that I think is really interesting to me. So how did, or at what point did Umbraco come into that process?
Sure. Actually, we had a small team in Belgium working on Umbraco probably for the last 3 years. Walters Kluwer, like many large companies, experiments with different, you know, website technologies from WordPress to Umbraco to Liferay to, you know, many, many others. You know, there are dozens of web CMSs out there. And we just had a proliferation of those. But the team that was working in Belgium really took an interesting approach, one that really removed the developer or the engineer or the designer from the go-to-market equation, which is, you know, in my mind, what I call they really implemented WordPress principles. Is a term I like to use. You know, take the technology, stand up a site very quickly, you know, deliver the empty site, they load it with their content. If they need extensions or plugins developed, you know, there's a repository for those. But pretty much from a technical support standpoint, it's hands off from any IT or development team. And they had some really, really good responses on a number of fronts. One, The marketing teams really felt that they had their shackles removed from IT, and there was really good feedback and buzz in the marketing community about the experience and what the Belgian team had delivered for them. They were able to go to market much, much quicker. They were able to integrate the analytics tools of their choice to analyze their effectiveness in their go-to-market strategy. And it was just really easy. It was very comfortable, right? Rather than buying a big web CMS, say like Sitecore or IBM WebSphere or Adobe, there wasn't a lot of implementation cost. It was very quick. It was light. It was agile. And they just had really good business results as a result of that. And that was really the impetus there. And that's how Umbraco, after 2 years of usage in Belgium, really popped onto the global radar. And through, mind you, that team had implemented Umbraco kind of on-prem using the open source platform. Now, when we went to do our technology evaluations for the project that I presented at US Fest, Umbraco popped in, and the Umbraco Cloud was really the target there, because our objective was finding a SaaS solution as opposed to an on-prem or managed hosting solution. We really wanted a SaaS solution going forward that was low cost, had some level of uptake internally already, and would be an easy, agile type of migration story to sell to our businesses.
And so the cloud part is almost as fundamental to what the solution you're describing as the Umbraco platform itself.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Umbraco has hit on what I would call nearly the perfect balance of technology and SaaS, SaaS capabilities. They have a very nicely packaged solution for both developers and our marketing folks. Really, if our marketing folks are familiar with the Umbraco back office and all of its capabilities, there's no change for them. Well, the change for the developers really unleashes the developers as well from any IT or infrastructure type of requirements that go into a project. It really does move the whole cost equation forward in terms of eliminating infrastructure costs. It's a subscription. It really does just take us directly to code for implementing solutions for our business customers.
So can you describe a little bit about like the actual structure of everything you have set up? Because I know that e-commerce is an important part of the jigsaw as well, but there's also integration with back office tools and some other things.
Oh, yeah. We e-commerce is less about the engine and the UX in terms of percentage of the time you spend in implementing an e-commerce project, and much more about the integrations with back office and enterprise tools, especially when you're dealing with a large company, a medium to large size company. Small to medium companies, yeah, you can get away with batch jobs and reports and lightweight data transfer models. But when you're dealing with, large to global enterprises, back offices become very, very heavy. And the requirements of coordination of data between front office and back office become much more heavy. So in terms of where it fits in, e-commerce is definitely a big piece of the solution that we're implementing for one of our divisions. UConnect is really the data transformation and transport tool that we're using, which is part of the e-commerce suite. And from there, we integrate through BizTalk services that are exposed and secured over the internet, or services hosted in IBM Information Bus. And it's really at that point that we transition from front office to back office. So that middleware layer, either in BizTalk or IIB, is where we hand off to the back office teams. And we work with them closely, every day for most of the days, about submitting order data, getting order status, shipping status, order changes or change requests, and things like that. And not only that, but promotions and discounts and, you know, the things that, that marketing lives on, right? So we tend to be the interface for our, the technical interface for our marketing teams to our back office teams, which really have no business interface. They're back office, you know, SAP ERP support teams. So we tend to be, the translation layer.
So can you talk a little bit about the process of going from, you've identified the major pieces of the jigsaw and Braco Cloud and a few other pieces, process of going from that to the actual implementation, building a team and the actual technical implementation?
So going from the recommendation to the business acceptance of the recommendation through to launch is taking us about 9 months. I have a saying about these projects. They always take 9 months. Doesn't matter whether you plan it for 12 months, it'll take 9. If you plan it for 6, it'll still take 9. that's just the nature of these types of migration, what I call migration projects. So typically we, you know, an engineering or a technical team make a recommendation, discuss it with the business will say yay or nay or have questions and want things changed. By the time you receive business approval is kind of when I start the clock ticking. So you have a go for the project and then you start building the team out. So we did build a team out to do this, and we transitioned some people from an existing team and augmented them with people with Umbraco and e-commerce skills. And we started work. The up and running, getting the team up and running for the folks that had Umbraco skills was very, very easy. It took all of a week and a half, 2 weeks to get a full team up and running. And what that involves is development tooling, development configuration, local environments, cloud subscription, a repo, connecting that repo through, you know, build tooling to and scripts written for deployment to the Umbraco cloud, all in a week and a half to 2 weeks. And from my experience, it's very, very quick. It could be shorter for smaller projects, smaller teams, things like that. We executed our first build and deploy to the Umbraco cloud in that kind of time frame. And that's kind of the way I measured it, is from the time you have the go from the business to when are you successfully able to successfully deploy to the Umbraco cloud. And it took about a week and a half, all of the integration tooling, configuration, training, all that stuff. So very, very quick. You know, from my experience, it's very, very quick for a team that's, you know, about a dozen developers plus the complement of testers. And that did include testing configuration as well, you know, baseline test scripts or test containers is what I call them, you know, for working with the Umbraco cloud. And from there, it just became, you know, a sprint cadence. And we're actually just coming up on the end of that, moving into a UAT phase with the business that'll last 4 to 6 weeks. So we kind of bookend our projects or our development sprint cadence between project ramp up and UAT and business acceptance of the project. And that takes 9 months. So, you know, 2 weeks to ramp up, you know, 4 to 6 weeks of UAT and issue remediation plus sprint cadence in between.
So 9 months actually doesn't seem like it seems like a relatively short timescale for the scale of projects you're talking about. Do you have a very clear understanding with them at the start as to what they're going to see in this UAT phase?
Absolutely. And that's where my team doesn't necessarily do the design and the UX. We do the core development of templates, business logic, back office integration, search integration, all of the real development required to deliver this stuff. We typically receive our UX in parallel with our sprint cadence as needed to feed the project schedule. And so we coordinate our development efforts with an external agency that does UX development, front-end development. And that's how we receive that. So yes, there's very clear acceptance and understanding with the clients about what they expect to see. So they've already gone through a design phase, UX development phase that resulted in basically click dummies or prototypes that they've approved. Those get submitted to our business analyst, which then elaborates each and every facet of those UX comps that we receive. as well as the cuts of the HTML, JavaScript, CSS that get further enhanced by my team. So yeah, there's a very clear understanding of what's expected and then the use of acceptance criteria as we walk through each one of our sprints.
And this might be a good point to go back to the role of the different agencies in the whole project. So you've touched on a couple of different things, staff augmentation within your team, but also the design front end agency. Can you, I guess, just talk about the whole picture there, like where and how do these agencies fit in?
Right. So within the division that I work with, we have a UX competency center. These guys are very good, very senior, and they augment their team with various agencies. Basically, they have a preferred agency list that they draw from. Oftentimes, our marketing folks are very experienced as well, and they have their own preferred list of agencies. And between the two, they find commonality or not. And it really has to do with the relationship between either the UX professionals within my division or the relationship of the VP of marketing in our business units with a specific agency. So oftentimes agencies come in through prior experiences. In UX is where we see a lot more agencies, different agencies used across the company. So that has led to different standards being used and implemented in our customer-facing end product, which we're trying to discourage. So those agencies used are typically contracted for a specific body of work, be it a strategy project that results in a go-to-market type of strategy, or a UX development phase, or a different SOW or a body of work to develop the actual front end of the product or the website that it will be developed by my team. Those are usually fixed cost engagements that our businesses and even my division works on. So the effort required to execute those is pretty well known. And it can be easily scoped in a conversation with my counterpart in the UX team or with our marketing folks. After that work is done, it's typically handed off to more of a development-focused agency. We use a number of different offshore companies. We manage onshore, do the work offshore quite a lot, and we have a much shorter list of preferred development agencies that we work with to actually do more core development on these products. So that's kind of the distinction that we make between UX and development and testing are the three segments that we typically use different agencies for, because different agencies have different competencies, skill sets, and things like that. It's hard to find even in the larger consulting organizations like even Avanade or TCS or HCL, it's hard to find consistent competency with different technologies.
Wonderful. Okay, that one makes complete sense. So I guess without getting too deep into the technical or the development space, I'm interested in a little bit about the development process you described and some of the tooling you use.
So our team uses Visual Studio. I mean, it's Embraco, right? It's WooCommerce. It's .NET. So Visual Studio is what our developers use. Some of our testers use it as well for the different test suites, but our testers will also use Eclipse to write their test scripts or do their test development for Selenium, for instance. So it's really the test execution is the automated test execution is done through Selenium, and then manual testing and tests, kind of checklists that they have. But our development process is exclusively done in Visual Studio. Our repo of choice is Bitbucket, and we basically use the Atlassian suite. So Bitbucket to Bamboo to Jira and Confluence and things like that all help facilitate that process, which with the end point of the development process before we hit Embraco Cloud or production systems being Bamboo, and that's where we deploy from.
And so specifically the Embraco part, so is a lot of that, a lot of the integrations you're talking about and the WooCommerce suite, is a lot of that, I guess what I'm wondering here is how much of that is out of the box Embraco and out of the box WooCommerce versus a lot of either other packages or extra development that your team has done?
Well, the extra development that we've done is really we've used our proprietary branding libraries on the front end for the UX. The rest of it is fairly out of the box. the integrations that are required, we have developed an abstraction layer that is proprietary to Wolters Kluwer that supports our online services architecture between Umbraco and WooCommerce, despite the native integration. What that does is allow us to integrate in other e-commerce engines in the future if, you know, much more easily if we needed to. But it is fairly out of the box. I mean, we've developed, Umbraco extensions of our own that are fairly basic. The integration with, you know, different services is very straightforward. In terms of it all being an Umbraco cloud, I would say 90% of what we have developed is in the Umbraco cloud, with the remaining 10% being hosted in a UConnect environment that sits in Azure EU West, in the Microsoft Azure cloud, because UConnect requires its own machine, dedicated set of machines to run and perform the data transfers. And that's been all very seamless. So from our point of view, this is, I would say 90% out of the box, 10% hosted in UConnect. There are some things that we have developed in Umbraco that integrate with other content systems to pull in other content for, you know, content as marketing efforts that our different businesses have done. And those integrations are very, very extensive, highly custom, because of the nature of our business. We are a publisher and an information services company.
And so what about things like marketing automation or any of those kinds of the marketing, the client, the tooling?
Yeah, for the group that we're working with right now doing this first large project for, this is, we are integrating with Eloqua, and we are integrating through Forms. So Eloqua Forms, we've worked with the Eloqua team to receive their published forms. We have an Eloqua Forms component in Umbraco that our marketing teams can deploy, identify the form, load the form identifier into it, and size it, shape it, stylize it, and publish it.
So just to finish up, a couple of questions. One on, I guess, on the challenges or the problems. What are the biggest difficulties that you, particularly connected to the Umbraco and the Umbraco Cloud side of the project, that you faced? And maybe what recommendations would you give for people facing similar situations?
Well, I would certainly say some of the challenges we have faced are not really technical, but more in program management, timing, cadence of the different teams, delivery schedule, things like that have gotten out of sync here and there. But for the most part, I mean, I think the program has gone smoothly. When working in a highly distributed, agile manner, that can be challenging. You know, everybody wants to be agile, but in geographically distributed teams, that does present challenges. So a little more attention needed to be paid to sprint planning. It couldn't be done as agile as, say, the evangelists for agile methodologies would recommend. It needed to be a little more predictable, and we ran into some issues around that. But for the most part, using the technologies has gone, exceedingly well. Very, very few. I mean, I think I can count the number of support tickets that we had to open with either Umbraco or WooCommerce on one hand. So the technologies are solid. I mean, we have experienced professionals working on this project, and it has really been freeing the using Umbraco and WooCommerce because of the professionals on their teams have done a very good job at segmenting roles and responsibilities in the technology itself. Roles and responsibilities are very clear when you're using Umbraco and WooCommerce. So there isn't a need for a lot of support from them. Good for them. And we've carried that forward as well in our development. And that makes everybody's lives a lot easier.
Yeah, I've used the word freeing and then unleashed and a couple of times as well. I think that's an interesting feeling to come out, because particularly if you're nearing the end of a big project, quite often it doesn't, it's not so, the feedback isn't so positive.
Oh, right. And we're doing a test with this project as well. We have another division in the company that's highly interested in the work we're doing for their sister division. And we've just gone through an estimating phase to literally take what we've done for this first division and copy it over and prepare it for a second division. It really is their own dedicated instance. It will take less. It will take literally a week and a half to prep and deploy a complete solution for a completely separate business. And the majority of that time is spent loading their content. And when I mean content, I'm talking about really mainly product catalogs, some external data sources, things like that, as well as testing it and preparing for them to execute a proof of concept against. So in the grand scheme of things, a week and a half to prepare a proof of concept. I mean, I remember the day when a proof of concept was 6 months for something like this. We've got it down to prepping a proof of concept down to a week and a half. I mean, talk about freeing and being unleashed. We really believe we've hit the sweet spot in terms of balancing the technology with the business needs and requirements.
Well, like I said, I really, really appreciate your time. That's a really fascinating topic, and I'm sure our listeners enjoyed that as much as I did. Final point, I think you're talking at CodeGarden, is that correct?
I am. I will be in Copenhagen talking at CodeGarden on June 7th.
So if anybody's listening and going to CodeGarden, they get a chance to hear a little bit more information from yourself and perhaps even catch up. But anybody who isn't lucky enough to make it to CodeGarden, where can people find you?
People can find me on Skype. My Skype handle is dsheridan, dsheridan. Or you can find me on LinkedIn as well at the same handle.
Thanks, Dan. I really appreciate all of that.
No problem, Barry. Thank you for your time.
You can get all the links and notes from this episode on happyporchradio.com. If you enjoyed the show, please spare a moment to leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. Thanks for listening.